This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. Don't turn that dial. I've got a great show lined up for you today. I've got Mr. Lawrence Reed, who's president of the Foundation for Economic Education, joining me momentarily. I'll get to that conversation in just about 2 minutes. Mr. Reed recently published an article that caught my eye. The title of the article was, Are We Rome? And he did a tremendous job outlining the parallels of not only social policy, warfare and welfare policies, but also monetary policies of the Roman Empire, and draws some very scary parallels to the same policies that really we have here in the United States today. So we're going to talk to Mr. Reed momentarily about what are those parallels, where are we headed, what lies ahead, and what might it mean for you and your money. I know you're going to find the conversation to be fascinating, and again, I'll get to that in about a minute or so. I want to remind you also that we do have the Everything Financial Radio program available in podcast form each week, so you can listen whenever you'd like. All you have to do to become a subscriber to the podcast is visit the iTunes store, and you can search under the term Everything Financial Radio at the iTunes store, and you can subscribe, and the two podcasts will be delivered to you every week, and you can listen wherever you like. I want to also remind you that we do have coming up in November a couple one-day classes of new retirement rules. The new retirement rules class talks about money cycles and economic cycles. We'll talk about that more on today's program as well. And where we are in those cycles and what it might mean for you and your money. We believe that where we're headed economically speaking and where we're headed from a fiscal standpoint, fiscal perspective, is very predictable. And we talk about that in detail at the New Retirement Rules class. You can get more information about the class at newretirementrules.com. You can also register there while capacity remains. And when you do sign up for the class, you'll also get a copy sent to you of the New Retirement Rules book that just came out here about a month ago. So again, the website, newretirementrules.com. I'm very pleased to have back on the Everything Financial Radio program Mr. Lawrence W. Reed. Mr. Reed is the president of the Foundation for Economic Education. I've been a big fan of their work. And Larry, welcome back to the program.
Hey, my pleasure, Dennis. Thank you so much.
Larry, let me just jump right in, because you published an article titled, Are We Rome? Can you just explain a little bit about the premise of the article, and then we'll jump in and talk about specifics. By we, who do you mean?
Well, by we, I mean the United States of America specifically, we Americans, but you could also pose that question for Western civilization in general. And the theme of the article is that there are important lessons from the history of ancient Rome, especially the Roman Republic, and that there are parallels, alarming parallels, between the fall of the Roman Republic and recent developments here in the United States and across much of the West. And those developments include the rise of the welfare, warfare state, for want of a better term, the idea that government should not simply protect the peace and the common welfare for everybody, but rather get into the business of foreign adventures and lots of spending for special interests at home. Rome went that path and ultimately became not only bankrupt, but also lost its freedoms and became an imperial autocracy or dictatorship.
So, Larry, that's pretty alarming, and the words now of my history professor are echoing in my ears. The history professor said that those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. Talk a little bit about just the political structure of Rome and compare it to the political structure of the United States today. You use the term republic. I thought that was interesting, and that's something a lot of listeners might not be aware of.
Well, the Roman Republic was born in around 500 B.C., 509 B.C. to be precise, when the Romans, just like the Americans did in 1776, the Romans threw off a monarchy, and once they were free of that, they were so tired of the centralization of power in the hands of one man that they established a Republican form of government, which involved due process, separation of powers. They had two people at the top, the highest positions. They were called consuls, and one could veto the decisions of the other, and they were term limited to only 1 year. So they were looking for ways to limit the concentration of power in the hands of any one person. They did that through term limits, through the rule of law. They established a Senate representing the people of Rome, more precisely the noble families. It wasn't a perfect republic. But on top of the Senate, they also had popular assemblies with lots of Romans enjoying the right of citizenship and voting for their representatives in those assemblies. So it never was a perfect system. They even had slavery for all of Roman history, so not everybody was free. But nonetheless, it represented the greatest advance for individual liberty and small representative government in the history of the world. And, of course, we paralleled that and did the same thing at the time of the American founding. It's just that Romans didn't keep it. After about 500 years of that, they lost it all through a steady erosion of the Republican values of limited government and responsible citizenship, and the rise of things like power lust, the welfare state, looking to government to get something at the expense of others. The late economist Howard Kirchner, I think, summed it up well when he said that when a self-governing people confer upon their government the power to take from some and give to others, the process will not stop until the last bone of the last taxpayer is picked bare. And that's certainly exactly what happened to Rome. I'd like to think Americans can profit from that example, learn from it, and turn back from this destructive path that we're on that so terribly parallels the decline of ancient Rome.
You know, another thing that pops to mind, Larry, that the Romans started to devalue the denarius about, I think, 1 AD or so. The denarius was a unit of currency, and certainly to fund this excess spending, the denarius ultimately ended up becoming a fiat currency. There's certainly some interesting parallels with what's happened to the U.S. dollar over the last 40 years and the denarius at the time of the Roman Empire's fall. Can you comment?
Yeah, you're right, Dennis. There's a big story just in the currency of ancient Rome, and its interesting parallels to the United States all by itself. Actually, it was Emperor Nero in the 50s AD who really got the country or the Roman Empire on this path. Before that time, as the Roman welfare state grew and they needed more money to hand out to various constituencies, the Romans would simply send the military to the silver mines in the gold mines and tell them, dig a little deeper. But with Nero, I don't know who it was, whether he thought of it or somebody else came to him and with the idea, but he basically decided that, hey, we don't have to have more gold and silver when we want to spend more. We can just cheapen the currency. And he started the process of calling in the coins and then melting them down, mixing in a lot of cheap junk metals, and then minting new coins out of that mixture so that the precious metal content of each coin was reduced. And that's how they financed much of the growing welfare state. They cheapened the currency. But, of course, that led to a soaring price inflation and various panics in the economy and ups and downs and depressions. In fact, by the time of Emperor Aurelian, around 270 A.D., the Roman denarius, which was 96% silver under Nero, two centuries before, by the time of Aurelian, it had fallen to less than 1% silver, and they'd had a lot of price inflation in the meantime.
Well, it's a fascinating conversation. We are talking today with Mr. Lawrence Reed, who is president of the Foundation for Economic Education. And we've got a minute left in this segment, Larry, so it'd be a perfect amount of time for you to let the listeners know how they might go learn more about your work.
Okay, I would recommend they visit our website, which is FEE, Foundation for Economic Education, fee.org. If they're interested in Rome in particular, all they need to do is to go to fee.org Rome, and then they'll find a lot of resources organized under this topic that we're talking about today. But the whole website is a treasure of 70 years of commentary, freshly updated every single weekday, and lots of resources for teachers and students there, too.
Well, you your organization does great work. I'm a huge fan, and I'd encourage the listeners to go check it out. And the good news is we're going to continue our conversation with Mr. Larry Reed in the next segment when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. It's a pleasure to have Mr. Reed from the Foundation for Economic Education with us on the program today. He will be joining us again in the next segment. You know, in this segment, in keeping with the way we usually structure our program here today on the Everything Financial Radio program, I want to talk to you a bit more about Mr. Reed's question, and that question is simply, are we Rome? You know, in the last segment, Mr. Reed talked about a lot of the parallels between the Roman Empire and where the United States is today. And he talked really about three things. He talked about the rise of the welfare state. He talked about the fact that Rome was ultimately bankrupt. And he talked about the fact that the Roman emperors decided to weaken the currency or cheapen the currency, the denarius, in order to try to deal with the debt. So in this segment, I want to go back and examine those three things as they exist today in the United States. The rise of the welfare state. Are we ultimately bankrupt, and has the currency been cheapened in order to attempt to deal with large deficits and debt levels? Well, if we go back and simply look at the welfare state and look at starting with government spending, in 2014, governments in the United States, this is a federal government, state government, local government, all governments combined, are expected to spend nearly 40% of gross domestic product. Now, if you're not familiar with gross domestic product, it is simply the economic output of our country. So 40% of the economic output, I should say nearly 40% to be accurate, of economic output is being spent by governments. Governments in the United States, according to the website governmentspending.com, will total $6.3 trillion in 2014. Well, where does all that money go? Well, about $1.2 trillion a year is spent on pensions, including Social Security and government employee pensions. Governments will spend about $1.3 trillion a year on health care, and that is principally Medicare and Medicaid. Those are considered to be welfare programs, even though you've paid into Social Security, and calling Social Security or Medicare and Medicaid a welfare program might seem like a bit of a slap in the face. That's what they're considered to be. Now, historically speaking, that number has gotten a lot larger. According to the same website, usgovernmentspending.com, government spending in the United States has increased from 7% of gross domestic product about 100 years ago, a little more than that, in 1902, to almost 40% of GDP today. Government spending in 1902 started at 6.9% of GDP. Some of you may remember back in 1995 when then-President Clinton said that the era of big government was over. Seems that he was wrong. Spending dropped back to 21% of GDP immediately after World War II, but it climbed until it hit a peak of 35% of GDP at the bottom of the recession in 1980 to 1982. Thereafter, government spending chugged along in the mid-30% of GDP until the mortgage meltdown in 2008. At that time, government spending reached 41% of GDP. Now, there was an interesting blog, an interesting op-ed written by a gentleman by the name of Professor Williams. He is Vice President for Policy Research at George Mason University. And I want to give you a bit about what he said, because I think it really outlines what Mr. Reed was talking about on the last segment, and that is that the United States is taking a parallel path to that of Rome. And Rome, ended in disaster. It ended in the fall of the Roman Empire. Here's what Professor Williams says. He says there's no shortage of real and imagined crises vying for the headlines these days. Left relatively unchallenged, largely ignored, or often denied by Washington and the media, however, is one of the gravest internal self-made threats to our economy, the crisis of government debt. Most economists agree that the United States federal debt poses a real and serious problem for our future, but for the debt deniers, such warnings fall on deaf ears. As the latest Congressional Budget Office report notes, even with a recent and temporary decline in budget deficits, government debt continues surging to historic levels. In 2007, for example, debt owed to outside investors was about 35% of the nation's GDP. Now, that's just 7 years ago. Today, this debt level is 74%, or nearly three-quarters the size of our economy, and there's no sign of this getting smaller. Yet, even this projection is optimistic. This assumes that Congress will do the right thing and maintain the spending controls currently written into law. They don't have a very good track record when it comes to restraint of any kind. And as we're sitting here in political season and all the ads are on television saying that we're going to balance the budget and cut taxes, it reminds me of every campaign I've heard in the past, all empty promises. President Obama, arguably a pretty liberal guy, had a 2010 National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform acknowledge the gravity of the situation. The National Commission reported and warned that America's long-term fiscal gap is unsustainable, and if left unchecked, we'll see our children and grandchildren living in a poorer and weaker nation. There's lots of models to project the growth of the debt. One of the models that I like to use comes from Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff of Boston University. Professor Kotlikoff has been a guest on the Everything Financial Radio program here several times. He says that if you add up all of the IOUs and liabilities and stack the IOUs and liabilities on top of actual debt, the true fiscal gap in the United States is $205 trillion. That's $650,000 of debt for every American alive today. In fact, those who say we're going to tax the rich in order to solve the problem, don't bother to tell you that in order to do that, you've got to tax 88% of all income earned over $167,728 a year, and that's just to balance the budget at today's level. It doesn't count increases in Medicare and Social Security spending, and it doesn't count paying down debt. Now, Mr. Reed in the last segment said that the Roman Emperor Nero in 50 AD grew the welfare state, and rather than having the mining companies go out and mine more money to get the money was made of silver, he decided to just gather all the currency back in, melt it down, put in some weak metal, and debase the currency. And what happened? The currency was debased, and there was a massive inflation. What has the United States done? Well, if you take a look, going back to 1971, and I choose that year because that's the year that Richard Nixon eliminated the link between the U.S. dollar and gold, a $20 item that you purchased in 1971 would today cost $117.46. That's a pretty massive inflation, not unlike that seen in Rome. If you go back to 1933, when then-President Roosevelt confiscated the gold of American citizens in order to print money, a $20 item in 1933 would today cost $365.93. That's according to USinflationCalculator.com. And in 1913, the year the Federal Reserve was founded, if you take a look at what $20 would buy in 1913 and see how much it would cost to buy the same item today, $480.51. That is almost 2,300% inflation. That is significant. We talk about devaluation of currency. We talk about what you might do to protect yourself at our new retirement rules class. We do have a one-day class coming up in November. You can go to newretirementrules.com to get more information. Newretirementrules.com is the website. I'll be back after these words.
Give me your money, just give me money.
are listening to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen, and I have the pleasure of chatting today with returning guest, Mr. Lawrence W. Reed. Larry is the president of the Foundation for Economic Education, a terrific organization. And we are chatting today about really the topic, are we Rome? Meaning, is the United States really following the same path as led to the, or that led rather, to the collapse of the Roman Empire? And in the last segment, Larry, we talked about the fact that this welfare state develops and then gets legs. Can you talk a little bit about what happened in Rome and then draw a parallel to what's happening in the United States today?
Sure. Welfare states typically start small. When people discover that through the political process they can start voting themselves a living instead of just working for one, then they start down this path. In ancient Rome, among the early recipients of this redistribution of government taking from some and giving to others were the veterans. And you have to concede that it's important for the government to compensate those who put their lives on the line for the defense of the country. But in time, in Rome, this became a tool for the late leaders of the leaders of the late Republic, I should say, and then later the emperors, to buy the support of their own men by lavishing extravagant pensions and other benefits on the veterans. But the problem always is, once you single out one group and say, hey, you're entitled now to get a lot of goodies at the expense of everybody else, well, then how do you stop everybody else from climbing on the bandwagon? Because everybody else is going to start thinking, well, if they can get some, why shouldn't I? I mean, I'm important too. And so then there was a man named Clodius in the first century B.C. who ran for the office in Rome of tribune on a platform of free wheat for the masses, and he won. And that got the Roman government in the business of supplying free wheat, which is a very important staple of the Roman diet, to almost everybody. Successive emperors tried to cut it back, but only to find that people clamored for more. And within a century after losing their republic, and now with the dictatorship of the emperors in place, the Roman people had pretty much lost all taste for republican institutions, representative government, and instead were in favor of whoever could come by and give them something at the expense of everybody else. So it gathers steam unless somebody is persuasive enough to convince people that this is the wrong way to go. It ultimately bankrupts a country.
So, Larry, it's interesting in your article how you talk about the fact that higher taxes on the productive seems to be part of this pattern, because you've got to pay for this welfare state. And certainly we've heard a lot of political rhetoric over the last decade that don't worry about your taxes, we're going to raise taxes only on the wealthy. So this rhetoric is really nothing new, is it?
No, it's not. And one thing we should learn is that politicians in a welfare state become demagogues, self-interested demagogues who discover that, hey, I can score points if I single out some segment of the population, a minority, the wealthy in particular, and demonize them. And then I can champion as the protector of the rest of the public against these demons. And that'll make me popular, and I can also take money from those people and give it to my constituents. The problem is that it never stops there. In fact, it can't, because as you promise more and more, that minority of rich people just don't have enough to pay for all this stuff. So pretty soon, the middle class and then the lower classes all discover that they're paying for this too. It's like we're all in a big circle with each person having his hands in the next guy's pocket. We all think we're getting something, but we're ultimately robbing ourselves, not just that little segment over in the corner that the politicians have demonized.
So, Larry, when you look at where we are today from a public policy standpoint in the United States, certainly immigration's a big topic. Story out this past week that the federal government is now building residential centers for those crossing the border in Texas. Certainly seems to be adding to this welfare state at an exponential rate. Where are we in the process compared to maybe where Rome was when everything came tumbling down?
Well, I certainly don't want to suggest, Dennis, that once you go down this path, you can't turn around. I do think we're rather late in the process. But unlike Rome, I'm very hopeful that Americans will come to their senses before all these bills come due and we bankrupt ourselves, and hopefully we'll turn around. But, you know, the future will determine that. I just don't know for sure where we're headed, but it's not promising at the moment. Everybody's climbing on the bandwagon. And when you see a federal government that's $17.5 trillion in the red and still behaving as if there's just nothing that they're unwilling to throw money at, then you know we're late in this process. I mean, if anybody in Washington was really interested in the financial solvency of the country, they'd be saying, wait a minute, stop, we don't have the money. Every time a new appropriation request comes up for one thing or another, we should be saying, we haven't got it. We're half a trillion in the red just this year alone, $17.5 trillion in total, and we just haven't got it, no matter how worthy it is. Or let's cut spending someplace else if we want to spend more on something like these immigration centers. But instead, they just come back and say, well, here's something else to throw money on. Let's not cut anything anywhere else. Let's just pile on another obligation. That's the kind of fiscal irresponsibility that no nation can long survive.
You know, you're such a great economic historian, Larry, and one of the questions that comes to my mind, and I'm sure it's on some of the listeners' minds as well, you made a statement that there's an evolution, really, from a republic and democracy, at least there was in Rome, to really a dictatorship, as people say, well, that form of government didn't work. For those of us that are free market capitalists, that's a really, really scary thought. Is that evolution imminent, and has there been a time in any economy at any point in history that a nation's been this deep in debt and actually reversed things?
Well, yeah, there is a strong connection between the growth of the welfare state and the decline of representative and limited government, no question about it. You find not only Roman history, but in our history, that things that were once revered and respected, like the Constitution, limited powers for both the Congress and the President, these things get pushed aside because people decide, hey, it's more important that I get my benefits one way or the other. And you find in recent American history, not only the current president, but to some degree previous ones, but mainly this guy, they're cutting corners all the time, rewriting laws without following the appropriate process, ignoring the Constitution whenever they feel that, hey, that's in the way. We need something else here, and let's just kind of push the Constitution aside. That's what happens in a welfare state. People start living for the present instead of for the future. You know, early Romans, they planned for the future, so they sacrificed in the present. If they didn't have it, they didn't spend it. They adhered to the virtues of personal character that are needed for a sturdy, free people. But in time, when they got addicted to the political spending process, they all said, well, hey, let's get it now while we can. And Katie, bar the door. So if somebody else in the future gets the bill for this, well, so be it. We'll be gone. Well, that's the way we're behaving now, and we're losing our political liberties slowly but surely by salami tactics, one slice at a time. Just as Romans did.
Larry, there's an interesting dynamic in the world today, and I don't know if there's a historical parallel, but when you certainly look at what's going on around the world, you have the world's major central banks printing money, the equivalent of the Romans actually bringing the coins that were pure silver in and debasing the currency. The dynamic today all around the world is that there seems to be a race to the bottom from a currency perspective. Is this parallel to Rome really more than just a parallel to the United States? Could we say that the world is really following this path, or are there some bright spots out there?
Well, there are some bright spots, and I'll touch on some of those in a moment. But yes, this is a worldwide phenomenon starting more than a century ago with the rise of strong central banks and the progressive ideology, which has given us so much more government. And it's been moving in the direction of all-powerful government for a century now. So yeah, this has been going on for some time, but it can be turned around. There are bright spots in the world. If you look at the list of countries and their economic freedom, which is compiled annually by the Wall Street Journal, the Heritage Foundation, there's some other groups that do similar things as well. There are places in the world that remain great teaching lessons for us. One is Hong Kong. I realize that the Chinese are beginning to exert some bad influences there, but still, Hong Kong is the freest place in the world, and they are one of the most prosperous. Singapore is another one. They're not politically free, but economically they have considerable freedom. And everywhere you look, whether it's Hong Kong, Singapore, New Zealand, Australia, the countries that enjoy the greatest economic freedom, that limit their governments, in fact, in their activities, tend to be those that have the greatest economic opportunity. They feed and clothe and house people at higher levels. They have a better future ahead of them than the countries that have government running the show. I mean, it's one of the most powerful lessons of economic history. The freer you are, the more prosperous you are, the more problems you solve than if you're not free.
Larry, as we're having this conversation, the midterm elections are probably about 6 weeks off. Do you see anything happening politically in the United States that gives you hope that maybe we're going to reverse the course that we're on?
Yes, I'm hopeful. Certainly at the Foundation for Economic Education, where we work with young people, I'm seeing an explosion of interest in ideas of liberty. Young people, the more they understand that they're going to pick up the tab for this irresponsible policy of adding to the debt every year and federal spending, they're excited about these ideas of liberty when you share them with them, and they're wondering why they're not hearing them in their public schools. In the elections in a little more than a month, we'll see, I think, whether or not some of these ideas are taking hold. I'm optimistic. There are more candidates running for public office at the federal level this year who really, I think, believe in the virtues of limited government than I've seen in a long time. And a lot of them have a very good shot at winning. So I'm hopeful that we can make some progress in these elections. We'll see.
Well, our guest today has been Mr. Lawrence Reed. The organization is the Foundation for Economic Education. The website is fee.org. I'd encourage you to check it out. Larry, always a fascinating conversation. I really enjoyed it. Love to have you back, and thanks for being with us.
Anytime. Thank you, Dennis.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen, and thanks again to Mr. Larry Reed from the Foundation for Economic Education for joining us today. You know, in this segment, I want to build a bit on what we talked about in the second segment. Larry, in the first segment of today's program, talked about the fact that there are some really eerie and scary parallels to the path being taken in the United States today as far as social policy and monetary policy to the Roman Empire, and we all know how that story ended. You know, we talked in the second segment today about the fact that when the Roman Emperor Nero wanted to have more money to stimulate the economy, rather than going out and mining for more silver, because silver was really used as money at the time, Nero decided just to gather some of these silver coins up, melt them down, add some worthless metal, and multiply the amount of money in circulation. That was the early equivalent of printing money. Now, this has happened time and time again historically. In fact, a lot of folks aren't aware that this has actually happened four different times in U.S. history. Now, I call this evolution of money the money cycle. And when you study this historically, you see that money always seems to start out being something tangible, something that has real or intrinsic value. We'll call it hard money. Hard money has typically been gold or silver. Then as time evolves, paper money is introduced, but usually paper money is redeemable for hard money. The paper, which really doesn't have a lot of tangible or intrinsic value, is exchangeable at a given rate for the hard money. And then, as time goes on, and politicians deal with having to balance budgets and close deficits, they have three choices. They can raise taxes, they can cut spending, or they can print money. They almost always choose to print money. And eventually, this link between paper money and hard money is broken, and we have something known as a fiat currency. And a fiat currency, as the name implies, is simply money because someone says it is. The government, by decree, says this is money. So you have this money cycle. Hard money evolves into paper money with a link to hard money, which evolves into a fiat currency. And historically speaking, we know fiat currencies have a 100% track record of failure. Now, I'll give you a couple of quick examples of this. You know, from 1834 to 1933, gold was used as money in the United States. Now, there's a couple exceptions to that during that time frame, but for the most part, a $20 gold piece contained 1 ounce of gold. So an ounce of gold sold for about $20. In fact, if you think pre-1965 here in the United States, silver coins were actually made of silver. Isn't that a novel idea that we make silver coins actually out of silver? And during that time frame, up until 1965, there was paper money that circulated that was redeemable for the real silver coin. These were known as silver certificates. If you had a $100 silver certificate, you could go redeem it for $100 of silver, which equaled 72 ounces of silver. Paper money was redeemable at a fixed rate for hard money. Then we started to make silver coins out of not only silver, but some worthless alloys were added, and now there's no silver in silver coins. In fact, in 1971, the U.S. dollar actually became a fiat currency. There was no link to any hard metal. Now, this money cycle leads to economic cycles, and I'm going to be limited on time today, but I want to give you just one example of how this money cycle leads to economic cycles. Now, there's two ways that this money can be created in this money cycle. The first way is that the link between hard money and paper money is loosened. I'll give you a good example. Gold was sold for $20 an ounce for 99 years, as we've already stated, from 1834 to 1933. After World War II, gold was arbitrarily priced at $35 per ounce, so the link was loosened. The second way to create money is just to print more, and that's what the Federal Reserve has been doing here since the financial crisis. Well, one outcome of money creation is the creation of asset bubbles. Give you a really good example. If you go back to 1913, the Federal Reserve, the same Federal Reserve that sets monetary policy today, was created. Shortly after the establishment of the Federal Reserve, the amount of gold that backed U.S. dollars was reduced from 100% to 40%. And what happened? The money supply expanded by 250%. If you're a mathematician, you can do that reverse math. Well, consequently, some bubbles were created in the 20s. The 20s were known as a period known as the Roaring 20s. However, from 1921 to 1926, there was a real estate bubble that built and then subsequently burst. At the height of the real estate bubble, like the height of the real estate bubble here not long ago, you could see really irrational behavior. In fact, the real estate bubble was really in high gear in Florida. City lots in Miami, according to several accounts, were bought and sold as many as 10 times in a single day. That sounds a lot like Phoenix condos in 2006, doesn't it? Foreclosures starting in 1926 started to escalate. They did not peak until 1933. And after the real estate bubble burst, the stock market bubble burst as well, as you all know. Well, these bubbles are created by easy money and debt accumulation, and it's very, very predictable. And when you look at a bubble and you chart a price bubble, one of the characteristics that all bubbles have in common, from my experience and my study, is that they're symmetrical when charted. They take just about as long to build as they do to unwind. And they often return to their starting point or even below their starting point. Now, if you look at the most recent real estate bubble, in 2003, the federal funds rate, the interest rate that the Fed sets, was between 1 and 3%. It was 1%, and then slowly it rose up to 3%. But in the meantime, real estate values went through the roof. All this easy money had to go somewhere, and it went into real estate. Well, we all know how that story ended. It ended the same way in starting in 2006 and 2007 as it did in 1926, 80 years prior. When prices rise rapidly, a parabolic chart pattern, we call it, they typically decline rapidly as well. Now, when you take a look at where is all this easy money going, there's a lot of evidence, in my view, that it's been going to the stock market. The stock market, we believe, is in a bubble, and we believe we're nearing the end of this money cycle. And this cycle has happened time and time again. I could go back if I had time and share with you an account that the panic of 1837, when we saw a huge real estate bubble build and burst, followed by a stock market that bubble that built and burst, was caused by the money cycle, easy money and money being created. The Long Depression of 1873 was arguably caused by easy money. Back in the 1860s, President Lincoln had to finance the Civil War, and he decided the only way he could do that is to print money. He did it by removing the gold and silver backing of the U.S. dollar and added the backing of government debt. That created a real estate bubble that built and burst, as well as a stock market bubble that built and burst. It's important to understand history. It's important to understand these money cycles and economic cycles, particularly when it comes to managing your portfolio. We talk about the money cycle. We talk about economic cycles in our class. The class is titled New Retirement Rules. When you register for the class, you get not only the book, New Retirement Rules, but you also attend a one-day class. We have a couple one-day classes coming up in November. You can get more information by visiting the website, newretirementrules.com. Newretirementrules.com is the website. Again, you can get more information there, or you can register while capacity remains. Let me also remind you that if you'd like to listen at your convenience to any of our interviews with guest experts, the Everything Financial Radio program is also distributed each week in two podcasts. They are free. You can subscribe to the podcast by visiting the iTunes store and searching under Everything Financial Radio. You'll get all the interviews each week, and they'll be distributed on Tuesday and Thursday each week. So again, just visit the iTunes store and search under Everything Financial Radio, and you can become a subscriber. That's our program for this week. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for listening.